This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I don't need a biography.
No, that's fine.
Perfect. Okay. So there's a number of kind of pivot points that we could orient this discussion around. And there are a number of others that it might evolve into orienting itself around. But one of them is, again, say, Charles Bernstein's idea of accessibility, the lack of a predetermined interface, namely leaving it to the reader to make some sense of a repository that might be built. There's a number of projects that we each in our own way, I would say, espouse, in which we are not simply making information available, but we're taking a stance and we have a pedagogy associated with it. And so in that sense, we could think of them as these initiatives that we're each in our own way espousing as projects, not as kind of simply benign institutional attempts at making a repository, building a repository. So that's one thing that we could discuss. In the case of Ubu, I was just saying to Kenny, I see Ubu as a very accessible project that there's no difficulty in finding material in the site, whereas with Slot, there's an archive in which, to some degree, you have to know what you're looking for. It is not made evident what has happened in the past and keywords that you could search under, names that you could be specifically looking for. You already have to know what, in fact, you're in searching for. And I'm interested in personally in that notion of an archive that is either unreliable or to some degree invisible, or to some degree too expansive to kind of just take invisibly. But so any event, so the idea for the evening was, could we kind of find certain issues that we cohere around enough that we could kind of use them to disagree or to start a discussion? So with that, I'll open it up. One thing that we had discussed this week was the fact that we might begin by discussing certain kind of precursor projects and kind of how they set up a direction that each of them in their own way are leading to. Brian, do you wanna start on that note?
Can I just read? I thought we were going to read little things. actually, maybe we should at least tell you what our names are. I'm Brian Steffens, this is Craig Dworkin, this is Kenny Goldsmith, this is Darren Wershwood-Henry from Toronto, New York, Princeton. I won't read the whole thing, but...
Let's give a sense of what the
projects are. So basically, my own activities in regards to archiving poetry and digital media have been threefold. One has been to create a series of PDFs, which are Adobe Acrobat files, which are downloadable, printable, nicely typeset files of old and, you know, reprints and new manuscripts of primarily experimental poetry for the for Kenny's site, ubu.com. The other thing has been to, I have my own site and I do PDFs for that one as well. And those are kind of more kind of idiosyncratic things like the collected critical writings of Steve Evans or the political science writings of Bruce Andrews. You know, clearly projects that are not going to make money or be high, you know, you know, they might not even be read on the site. And then the third thing has been my most recent site, which is Circulars, which is, to quote my statement here, a site created to provide a means for poets to speak on issues of American involvement as policing the world and its rapid approach, I think we've already gotten there, to adopting a philosophy of exaggerated military prowess to influence world politics. So the Slash Ubu series is, you know, had books by such writers as Kevin Davies and Madeline Gibbs, reprints, as well as newer texts. And my idea with that is that, I mean, the nice thing about the PDFs is that, you know, a lot of these small presses are not able to really do reprints or to publish, you know, lost classics because, you know, you probably can't even sell 500 copies of a reprint of something like Kevin Davies' Pause Button, but clearly a PDF series will let you do that. Well, I've already mentioned on Aris.net, let me just jump to the kind of more theoretical last paragraphs, starting with Circulars. Circulars is a multi-author blog. Several of the stories were posted by Darren Wershwood-Henry, who, among other things, digs up incredible pieces regarding the phenomenon of digital resistance, including hacktivism and digital detournement, thus adding a peculiarly anthropological element to what I had originally conceived of as a, quote, protest site of sorts, an announcement board for events, a platform for poets to articulate in what I was hoping would be unconventional but engaging manners the anti-war / pacifist kind of activist movement's aspirations. But also I thought it would be a great place to collect the unabashedly something, chatty, caustic, frank, vulnerable brand of social critique characteristic of the poetry blogs, poetry web blogs, which are kind of sprouting like mushrooms. Poets are creating these sites where they post their daily ruminations. Basically what I want to say in the light of these three activities is that I don't like to think of anything on the web as, quote, archiving, but as some form of activism. I call it, quote, teleactive activity, using a term from Lev Manovich to describe those artworks where, for instance, one sits behind their desk in New Jersey and communicating with a robot arm in Kyoto via the internet grows a geranium in Japan. My sense is that what we do on the web has to have some sort of dynamism to it, has to aspire, even if it is only a dream, to alter the avenues of distribution, cultural capital, et cetera, rather than simply to, quote, make something more available or freely available. I think of the web as a sort of carnival, to use a term from Bakhtin, a sort of heteroglossic text a la Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov or a play of Shakespeare's, in which many voices are actively, urgently, even opaquely at play off or against each other or in sync. The end might be the same, formatting something, running it through Adobe Distiller, putting it online, but the philosophy leads me to make distinctive decisions, I feel, or at least this aspect of carnival makes it interesting to me. Were everyone to start posting beautifully formatted PDFs online all the time, I might just find it far less interesting. So basically, that's what I do, and that's my angle. And one thing I would say at the end is that my sense is a lot of poets of my age, or you know, older or younger, ironically tend to be typesetters as well. And you'll find that, well, I know Kenny and Darren are both very competent typesetters, and I wonder what, you know, just the fact that a well-designed, I mean, if you look at a small print, you know, beautifully designed but small press book from back in the day, it would always look like a small press book, and that would kind of fix it in a particular realm of cultural capital. Whereas now, you know, with desktop publishing, we can design books that look as finely designed as, say, a Zone book or University of California book or a Knopf book. But of course, we just put it up digitally. We don't put it on in fun wraps or anything like that. So that's my message to things.
So actually preserving that all the information that comes with the look of a small press chapbook from 1978 is actually part of what's behind the project I've been working on, which is to create essentially digital facsimiles of reprints of out of print small press books that grew out directly actually from a pedagogy and an attempt to solve two versions of the same problem that for me as a teacher were professional problems. And one, sort of looked around at college courses and catalogs and asked, well, why aren't people teaching courses in contemporary poetry, courses in post-war poetry that have these major, important, interesting books? And it turned out that in part, they couldn't, because books from 15 years ago or 10 years ago were already out of print, were unavailable. And so I wanted to be able to teach seminars using these books and to teach them as really as a scholar, which is to say not dependent on what happens in the publishing world, but to teach them as historians. And so that drives actually part of the form of my project, which is that things need to be printable and they need to print out the same so that everyone in a class can access the information in the same ready way. And the flip side of that problem is that actually following from Bob's work, the literary histories of poetry in America in the 70s and 80s were starting to be written and are starting to be told in ways that I don't think accurately always reflects the work that was there. So that as you read books now, or you read articles now on the history of language poetry, it's a poetry at the center of gravity, of which is weighted late to my eyes, and passes over earlier work that is harder to get to in physical forms, but also harder to process. I think there's a difficult story that's there to be told, and so those two problems are part of what set up my project.
A couple of years ago, I received an email from a young woman living in a small town in Texas, thanking me for the materials that were available on UberWeb, and it was a small note, but an incredibly significant one for me, that spoke to really what we're about. And I think at the end of the day, it's maybe the content is one thing, but radical distribution is what we're interested in. We're interested in making available universally, making available materials that are unavailable otherwise. This girl certainly, say she was, I'm not sure what part of UberWeb she liked, but chances are if she went to her local library, they wouldn't have the anthologies of concrete poetry, or they wouldn't have LPs of sound poetry. And if she went to her local bookstore, even if it was a Barnes & Noble, such things wouldn't exist either. Where do you find them? And, you know, the fact of the matter is, UberWeb now, there's about 120 to 150 gigabytes worth of out-of-print sound poetry, MP3s, or historical artist sound recordings on UberWeb available. These are not even available to most collectors. I mean, I happen to have been a collector and have a passion for this stuff and a passion to see it getting out there. But anybody now, anywhere, can have this enormous collection of sound poetry, you know, that it's just not even available in New York City. And I mean, in this way, we're actually lagging behind now on UberWeb as a centralized distribution system. The freedoms and the vast radical distributive properties of the peer-to-peer file sharing systems. And often what I'm doing is I am now finding files on P2P file sharing systems and then bringing them back to UberWeb, making them accessible through the web for people that don't have access to those specific and often quite hidden. I think Aaron's idea about hidden interfaces is interesting because, I mean, it's taken me so long to finally find out the sources of where I can get the rare Fluxus or the rare Joseph Beuys MP3s through a very secret file sharing group. So the idea is I'm pulling things off of the file sharing groups now and posting them to Uber, which I hope they'll get disseminated in an incredibly radical way. So, you know, the interface for me is I want to create a beautiful environment. You know, you're spending time in a space. It's got to be beautiful. And because distribution is really our primary focus, the navigation should be very, very clear, and you should be able to get to the information instantly. I feel that the material that we're dealing with on UberWeb is so arcane and so obscure that to put an interface in that sets people going in different directions defeats the purpose of getting difficult work out there in the first place. So the navigation and the graphical sense of UberWeb is incredibly straightforward and direct.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the web is an incredibly flaky and messy technology. You know, it's a very, it's a very, very wide junkyard. You know, and I think in many respects that problem of the hidden interface or, you know, the arcane archive is that's always already there.
Mm-hmm.
When I guess the question of doing it, you know, for a while. of actually building material is an important question, because the web is also very, very thin, you know, and I think we're all interested in building deeper pockets of content. Because that's something that's absent from web culture, because it's a culture of technophiles. They like to build interfaces, they like to build eye candy, but they don't like real content. And it's because it comes out of graphic design. What I'm interested in, and what I was interested in the entire time that I was at Coach House, was trying to build an archive of actual content, you know, and it blows my mind that Coach House is still the only literary press in the world with its full front list online. There are over 70 full-length books there now. But the thing that has occupied me for at least the last 3 or 4 years are questions that came out of that enterprise. Like the second stage of building content is starting to look at questions of infrastructure and policy. I think it's less of an issue down here because you don't have that layer of government granting bodies that we've got in Canada. You know, you can't go to your government arts council and say, I need $20,000 a year to run my website. It raises other interesting questions, right? Like I started going up to Ottawa on a regular basis because we were getting all kinds of questions about, well, what are you doing to protect copyright? How are you structuring your licensing? Blah blah blah. And it
could.
Well, that led. I had to start writing the policy. I had to write 2 books on the subject. I wrote a book on online community, and then I wrote a book on intellectual property, free software, and the economics of information distribution inside networks. So I had to do the theorizing, and then I had to start building policy. You know, because you go to one department, you go to the Department of Canadian Heritage, and they say, well, is anybody else working on these questions? And you go to the Canada Council, and they say, well, is anybody else working on these questions? So simply by virtue of the fact that we were the only ones doing it, I ended up holding all of these strings and starting to try to tie these people together. And those are the questions that concern me, not only on the level of public policy, but on the technological level, because I believe that there are technologies that allow that kind of connection that writers should be interested in, things like free software, things like rich site summary and XML syndication, which allow you to share information on the front pages of websites with other sites, all kinds of searching and spidering technologies, peer-to-peer technologies. All of those kinds of things are tools that writers need to know about, and I think need to be much more cognizant of when they set out to pick the technologies that they work with. You know, what word processor do you use? What operating system do you use? Those things matter because they affect the kind of writing that you do.
Okay. So I'll follow up with my kind of statement of purpose, and then I guess we can just jump in. In terms of the slot projects, they're in an organic kind of state of evolution. And so they've gone through a number of phases. For two and a half years, they were a series of live events. Now there's a physical space. And so because of that kind of disjunction, I've been concerned with an interest in the notion of the residue and the recording, and how since the 60s in particular for me, there's been a number of unintended and unintended recordings from live events, from performative art practices, that have come to define over time the nature of that live event. So in other words, the afterlife of the event retroactively determines its significance, its meaning, and its ultimate kind of effect and register. In a similar way, following Badu and others, I'm interested in the notion, could there be a radical politics that would be embedded not just in a live event, but in its afterlife? And the repercussions of that have played out in a number of ways. In the case of kind of Louis Philitoc's project, where after a certain length of time, we felt that the audience was becoming less and less in person, and the online audience was building. So in other words, there was this notion that the live event and the residue from that event were one and the same, when to us, it was always, and to these projects, the notion is that they're fundamentally dissimilar. The recording of this event, in fact, has very little to do with the event itself. And the audience for this event is something that is determined over time, and the success of this event is something that requires an interface on the web. It needs to be returned to over time and checked against the moments that we live in. And so in this sense, it's played increasingly into this notion of the archival. How do you preserve this repository that's building of these live events that have been recorded?
There's an ongoing trend in geek culture to blog events as mm-hmm. they're actually happening. Like, mm-hmm. If you go to South by Southwest, there is invariably at least one person at the panel and two people in the audience all sitting there blogging straight to the web.
You were going to do this tonight.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, but I didn't know whether you'd have Wi-Fi, so I didn't bring my computer.
Maybe an Ethernet.
Okay, well, I mean, it was tempting, and I thought about it, but I wanted to resist it for the same reason that I'm resistant to, you know, eight people with video cameras at a mm-hmm. wedding, because sure. You get so caught up in the archiving of the event that the event itself is erased. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a meta event from the moment that you start. Mm-hmm. I think you're right that there's a fundamental dissymmetry between the live event and mm-hmm. the document that you've got after. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't want to see one side engulf the other. And
mm-hmm. it already has. Mm-hmm. Where do you draw the distinction? Why every event, you know, in a wired world is a meta event?
Yeah, I mean, like, you can do a Glenn Gould and sit in your studio, but you don't. I mean, you still do readings.
Yeah, but more and more, I think I actually agree with Aaron. I mean, more and more, I go to less and less readings.
No, I'm talking about performances, Kenny. You still perform for an audience.
Well, I mean, I could make a case that Ubu is actually an ongoing performance, an ongoing meta performance, really.
Yeah, and I wouldn't detract from that. But my point is that you still do public readings and you still do performances.
But less so, really.
Well, I would argue that I used to videotape a lot of Bhutto dance. There's a friend of mine named Boaz Bark, and he does dances on the streets of New York, which usually end up involving the people walking by, and I was excited about this whole idea, so I used to tape him. And then after doing it two or three times, it's like, yeah, I'm not watching the dances anymore. And I don't think Boaz would ever be taped, because he doesn't even tell people he's going to dance. And yet the presence, which is what the whole idea is, it's, going out into in front of St. Mark's with, dressed as an old lady, carriage, and people not not understanding that this is a dance or that this reality, the reality is essentially being shattered. I don't think you can catch that on. I don't think that could be adequately archived as a moment. We could imagine it. If there's a book, beautiful. Walter Benjamin writes a beautiful essay about Boaz Barkin, and then we have the video documentary. I think you can get some of the sense there in the poetry and the drama. But I don't know. I think there's always going to be some resistance to the utter digitization of all this. It's like what Brian Eno says about digital technology. Like prior to when synthesizers first hit, people stopped listening to acoustic instruments anymore. But then once digital technology came back, the sound of a guitar suddenly became more interesting again because we were just so inundated with artificial noises,
We're making, I think on some level, an artificial distinction because we're sitting on a kind of threshold where we're still attached to computers that are usually tied to walls. Mm-hmm. But that will change within 10 years. With Wi-Fi and 3G and everything else, the internet is like right away, like inches away from being ubiquitous. So it's just not.
Well, it's going to be an issue in the Western world.
Actually, these technologies are the things that are putting internet and cell phones in countries like China and in developing nations because they don't need the wired infrastructure, and they're infinitely more important there than they are here. And in fact, mainland China is going straight to cellular, right? Like they're skipping over the wired infrastructure entirely. Like in the middle of Russia, like the city of Minsk, after Perestroika, had like one long distance phone line for a city of a million people. That's not an issue anymore. It's
true. Well, I don't think that really matters, but okay.
Fascinating. Just one meta thing that seems to me strikes me is that but Brian really emphasized the present tense, circular, an unfolding rapid response to the tool. And Kenny, you were saying in terms of availability, you had the same orientation for it. expanding the place of yesterday, the book is democratic multiple. The web is democratic multiple. As opposed to the infinite and infinitely nuanced and infinitely potential of target space. One thing that really strikes me, just over focus on the last contention about third world, first world, vulnerability. I don't know how many people here know Lock War RV, the website, it's not the Russian military, but it's...
Yeah, it's translations military, from, yeah.
Experts who actually, I think coming out of the Russian embassy, would give very accurate reports of what was actually happening in the war, and they were completely different than what you got. Certainly at CNN, but even on the Times, in Guardian, or using Lefty. And once I found this, I became very, it was a weird way of breath of fresh air, because it sounded like this is actually, I guess some sense of what was actually happening. Then the U.S. Army military coalition destroyed, they bombed the target of the Russian embassy and the Russian convoy leaving Iraq. They also shot at the Germans from Jazeera and but in other words, the ubiquity of the web and the speed of the web at a certain point of emergence into visibility and viability, which I think we've really seen in the last 6 months, an extra literary sense or something literary sense. Once it gets to a certain point of viability, then it really is going to run into political, physical, coercive resistance. Obviously, it's like an act, so you can't. That seems like a really profound thing to face that potentialities. Have been emerged from and are still kind of cocooned in, military-industrial cradle.
Actually, the paragraph I didn't read here, in all my years of writing poetry, I've never been issued a cease and desist order, but I started putting these pieces on my blog, and 2 months later, I got a letter from the New York Times saying I couldn't do that anymore. I think there is a power, and it can be utilized quite effectively, and that it could erupt from any number of places. The Chinese hackers trying to hack U.S. government websites and bring them down as a protest against the war is a kind of, incident that we would never have conceived of years ago.
The neuromancer or the romance of the lefty guerrilla hacker suddenly takes place by the non-romance of coalition, war machine.
But interestingly enough,
possibilities.
Yeah, but they actually hired hackers to do that. I mean, the hackers that I know they're mercenaries, and they often don't have political allegiances. Very often they work for the government so that they're not jailed for some illegal, they're caught having taken down Yahoo or something. But rather than throw them in jail, the deal is struck.
There are at least two really, these are all issues or questions, but why infrastructure is so important. And there's a really good book by Lawrence Lessig called The Future of Ideas, and another one by Geert Lovink called Dark Fiber. And both of these books make the same argument that just because the existing structure of the internet allowed for the emergence of a libertarian culture and certain kinds of personal freedoms doesn't mean that that's inherent to the technology, and it doesn't mean that it can't be changed. And both of these books outline in very clear terms the kinds of changes that are being made both on the physical layer and on the layer of code to the internet itself to prohibit and lock down exactly that kind of culture. So, when writers, particularly writers who are new to the web or new to the internet, get on it for the first time, they fall in love with all of those kinds of possibilities, the possibilities of potlatch and free circulation and gift economies and so on and so forth. But yeah, it's not inherent to the space. It's there now and it's going away. And unless we start paying attention to other possibilities for resistance and for making particular choices about the kinds of tools that we use, those possibilities will disappear even more quickly than they already are.
Yeah.
okay, the use of Linux and other kinds of free software over Microsoft technology on the level of the server, the use of shareware and programs authored by independent companies over programs written by conglomerates, the use of web logging technologies built on free software rather than proprietary sites with commercial origins and commercial purposes, all of those kinds of things, and sites that have the sharing of information built into their infrastructure rather than things that are standalone and self-contained.
So would you say that, like, the commercial platforms have commercial?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I think it can be subverted, but I think there are better choices.
You mentioned that there were instances of things becoming more restrictive at the code level.
Yeah.
What are some specifics for that?
Okay, HTML is an open standard. The reason that the web spread as quickly as it did is because every browser on the planet allows you to look at the layer of code that lies under a web page and to copy it and to build a new site from it. If Microsoft had their way, you wouldn't be able to see any of that. And the new technologies that they're using in things like Microsoft.net are all about closing down open standards and putting in chunks of code that don't allow you to make the kinds of changes that we're used to changing.
I've seen those efforts fail time and again. Microsoft or anybody has never been able to really do that to make it work. It fails.
Yeah, but
lots of people, you know, in business buy into it, and lots of office workers are forced to live with that reality. But in the larger world, it really doesn't.
In the larger world, they have something like 90% of the software market. They have, you know, control over the kinds of computers that are used in education, the choices that people make about software licensing. All of those things are dictated by one very large corporation.
Well, sure, and they've been doing that for quite a while, but in spite of that, we've still got limits. You know, we've still got MySQL. We've still got all this peer-to-peer stuff that's coming along. It has nothing to do with Microsoft.
Well, this is what I'm arguing, is that it's the only effective opposition, because with Linux there's no one to sue and there's no one to buy, so it works. But if creative people don't start making investments in that kind of technology instead of just the geeks, then the battle is lost before it's even begun.
I have another question, not to.
I've been talking way too much. Shut up for one.
When I think of the web, I think of this kind of medium that is obsessed with the notion of the hyperlink. When I look at UberWeb, I look at Slot, I look at Dworkin's Eclipse, I see sites that in fact have no links to outside sites. Today I actually made the first links on Slot to an outside site, which were each of R5. But Arras is the opposite. Alienated is the complete opposite of this. It's comprised precisely of links to outside sites. Could we read this for indeed a significance, and is there anything to say about that inclusiveness versus that site which is built precisely upon its exclusivity?
I actually took my links page down, and it was one of my favorite pages on the site. But the amount of maintenance and the time I had to put into maintaining links
site.
I thought my time was better spent enhancing the content of the site. Things were falling out of date, and it also became like a thing about decision. It became sort of political for me. What gets put in, what gets put out, what gets left out, and also with this searching technology that's available today, I figured anybody can find pretty much anything that they need, which really wasn't the case 5 years. Well, when UberWeb started in 96, obviously you had to link to other sites. In other words, I kind of feel people know where to go and actually know where to find things these days. Maybe a little too much for your preferences.
Well, I mean, I'm dealing with this kind of perverse logic. On the one hand, because of the database that I've built up over the last 6 months, Google won't go into it, and I haven't made my URLs friendly. So they precisely won't index the very content I would ask them not to index. Sure.
How did that happen?
There are
for various reasons.
Code reasons? I mean, yeah.
There are a number of ways to look at it. On the one hand, a ton of search engines don't want to go into a database or a code that could be recurrent in which they can get caught in loops. In other words, a search engine works, it spiders a site, it kind of copies it, makes
there's
it
catch. There's no, like, billboard.
What you can do is put up HTML pages on the site that, that are indexes of what you have in the database.
True.
It won't be the actual page.
Exactly. And I could make a URL-friendly version without a question mark or without a kind of no-entry little file. But I'm specifically trying to bar them in a way. And then recently I've been working on these unreliable interfaces where I've kind of built up code that looks at all possible past events, which at this point is about 100 events if you include the 50 events from the 1963 Vancouver conference or 50 recordings. So we have about 150 events in the database. And then the code goes in there with seeded algorithms and randomly invents events based on possible past events. And there are certain rules. For instance, you know, Ginsburg is allowed to be in an event with Brian. But at the same time, if that is the case, then a certain recording from another event is called in. Or their bios have to be applied. So there's this notion that on close perusal, in fact, it becomes more and more evident that it's invented. But at the same time, it's believable. And it's this notion that I want to make explicit, even if this is a redundant concept with the web, the unreliability of a database culture or of the internet. There's also now, I've been working on these the reverse of Uber, where you have an artist index. I don't have that, but I have pages now that just randomly pull out queries or events from that database. And every time you reload the page, you get new events. So I've just been kind of in a laboratory, I've been trying to experiment with how could we engage with this repository, which is growing too large to be accessible anymore, and which is filled with a lot of esoteric, arcane practices to begin with.
What's too large? Slot?
Not slot, but kind of the sense that you could you could go into slot and get a clear sense of projects from the past and link them up with a specific agenda.
It's too big?
Not too big.
I mean, I don't understand the web, it never gets too big.
No, your site is far bigger than slot ever will be. I mean, the issue is I'm not really keen on making a site map.
How to get different bits of information from different parts of the site to somehow come together based on users, whatever they happen to be searching for.
Yeah, in the case of kind of, say, Kyle Schlesinger's Olson transcripts that we recently released, he had thought of it as a kind of maybe more of as a document, a transcript. I had seen it as a recording of an event that he had transcribed. So in the way that we have set up the database, or that I've set up the database, there's an event repository, there's a document repository, there's an image repository, and the issue was in the end that there are all these events in the database that are entered twice, they're redundant. They're entered into the document repository, they're entered into the event repository, so that none gets is made primary over the other.
Yeah. When I used to work with Fodor's travel books, and they were trying to put a database, all the travel guides, so that we could offer a web service where if someone would say, I want to tour the churches of England, all the various bits of data about the churches of England would come out. But the ultimate kind of way of sorting it was going to be geographic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every single bit of information was going to be sorted by, you know, whether or not it's in New Jersey. Well, New Jersey is a state in the United States, and Rutherford is a town in New Jersey. Ah, but actually, Bergen is a county, but Bergen had the same thing as a county in Ireland, mm-hmm. or what's the difference between Los Angeles and South Los Angeles, or, you know, South Central Los Angeles? It's just, the name's just been changed. So, I mean, it was just an interesting kind of, I mean, you would think that a geographic fact, you know, hardcore empirically based system would work for that, but even that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So
I kind of feel that in thinking about the thing that you've set up, that if I were to explore your interface and began coming up with things I wasn't looking for or fake pages, I would just close the window and move on. You know, in other words, you're assuming the luxury of people hanging out there and really getting into it and really feeling it. When in truth, people are looking for something, and then they're out of there. We're looking for the next clip. We're greedy for the next clip, which it might be a critique of you know, which,
but
fair enough.
At the same time, I'm also assuming that I don't expect that everybody's going to be interested in our project, although I will, at some level, try to engage them in a way that matches the spirit of the project.
I have bad news for you.
Okay.
I went to your site today to find out information about this event, and I found it instantly.
I know.
It was fantastic. I got the map, too,
But,
and the directions.
But guess what? Tomorrow, when this event is no longer in the upcoming calendar and displayed prominently, you're going to have a difficult time finding it.
Hmm. You should talk about the interface for Eclipse, because it was built by one of your guys.
Unless you tell the story about it.
Yeah. My job is to get people here, but once they're here, it kind of blends into this path that's lost.
Okay, I see that.
And that is the experience of the web.
In the future.
Exactly. Yeah.
So and so when it fades into the past, it goes into this kind of cycle somewhere.
I click a button, it's no longer upcoming, it's now archived. And suddenly it's denied any upcoming calendar status. And it kind of, it blends into the very categories under which it was currently in place. But because of the identity of the space, which is kind of amorphous, if nevertheless positive along certain axes, it's hard to kind of get to these past events.
Why not just delete them?
What's that?
Why even have them? Why not just delete them?
Because, again, the sense of a radical politics which may or may not be able to be ascertained or taken from these recordings. I'm not trying to be nostalgic. I'm not trying to say that, in fact, all of these events could be radical if only their attention, if attention was given to them. But the sense is that, for instance, our social mark conference with Toscano and others and Dirksen, it could be a complete flop. It could have been just important and useful in this moment. It could also be something the repercussions of which kind of need time to develop, and we need to return to it, and we need to listen to that recording over time and see if it applies now more than ever or less.
You cut your teeth at Writer's House, and I remember when you were doing the technology when I was there. Curious, I mean, how many people access and replay those files over and over again?
Incredibly few.
Which is really coloring what you're bringing here.
That's
interesting.
Yeah. I've often, I mean, Bob did the talk series out of San Francisco, which I've never seen any real adequate archive of, certainly. And I actually suggested to Charles Bernstein that someone should do like a good photo book history of the language school, because it seems like certain figures, like I finally saw Steve Benson do a performance in Manhattan, you know, after he had basically been in semi-retirement in Maine. And, you know, people that knew Steve Benson when he was doing these performances, which he improvises, but they're beautiful. I mean, I think it's among the most beautiful things I've seen. Yeah, and it had a lot to do with the presence thing, too. I don't think I would have quite enjoyed it quite as much listening to it on a CD or watching a video. But the fact that, you know, after having gone to so many readings in New York and seeing people just kind of mumble or, you know, block out the audience, to get someone up there and actually create a kind of dynamic that was very, you know, individual. So my point being that, you know, the whole phenomenon, I mean, just specifically the whole phenomenon of language poetry as a social, you know, happening in the 70s and 80s, it's gone now because so many people have retired to academia, or you know, they split off to become writers. And I think the between spaces that were being filled by the, you know, the ones kind of doing more interactive live things, which I think, you know, fed off of the more literary figures, is lost. And I think it, you know, detracts from what the younger poet's idea of the phenomenon of language poetry is.
Well, one thing that's really striking to me, Gavin, what you just said about
historical.
It seems to me you want an active, unpredictable, open past. The access in the past is as unpredictable. Sort of butterfly effect in the past. Mm-hmm.
It could make possible its own obsolescence in the process. I mean, but anyway.
Somehow, sort of counterfactual open possibility. Mm-hmm. And Craig, you seem like wanted for very much opposite of that, which is sort of, you know, that there is a crude, all these crude sound types circulating around, reductive, and you want a factual nuance that's really crucial to history and to values and to the informative question. It just seems like those are radically different.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's that distinction is one way to schematize pretty much everything that's been said from I mean, in some ways, my project is much more of an archive, in the sense that I think Brian's actually opposed to. But there's this tension that I think there's a technological substrate to that between fixity and an uncontrollable flux, which in some ways is between the impulse to archive certain kinds of content, which I want to do in very fixed ways, in facsimile ways. It's important for some of the Ubu, I was thinking about this, that you don't want someone to go in and take one of those concrete poems and, you know, take the silence poem and just list it in a list. You need a certain kind of form kept there. It's different from the impulse to distribute, and that in some ways the impulse to archive and the impulse to distribute, even though they're bundled in all of our projects, are in some ways actually counter impulses that would, I think, we could think through in some ways.
The interesting thing about Kenny's site, which would be interesting to hear him talk about, is that you can't link to a page in Kenny's site. It'll bounce you back to the home page.
No, that's not true anymore. I mean, I've worked so oppositely from Aaron. It's really interesting. My interface was much more confused before, much more complicated. There was a 1, 2, 3, sometimes quadruple frame set on the page, and it was impossible to link to it because it would only link to the master index page. And I was finding that was really bad. I found that people weren't able to find what they wanted or get to what they wanted, so I knocked frames out of the entire site and redesigned it. So as a matter of fact, everything is bookmarkable. It was a liability for me and not a plus. I'm always working to try to get it clearer and cleaner.
The notion of the archive. I was having a discussion with Marjorie Welsh about a year ago, telling her that I was about to go off to Calgary to work with Fred and Louis on these tapes and digitally preserving them at least for 3 years and then kind of having to do it again, etc. But and she got furious and she said, why are you using the word archive? There's a very subjective repository that Fred has built up and that you in turn will be working with and kind of assuming. But and to some degree I agree with that. I might use the word freely, the word archive, but I don't see the project as one that's engaged in archival practice. I do see it as one that's engaged in these discussions of obsolescence.
Just listening to this conversation, my site, you used to be able to not link to it, and then I removed the frames, and we were talking at dinner about the back end that Craig used to use for Eclipse, which he no longer uses because it's problematic, and Brian was talking about how he found, like, the first website that he built, you know, in, what, you know, whatever,
1997.
Yeah, and all of these things change. I bet everybody in this room who has had a computer for more than 10 years has floppies with stuff on it that their current computer can't access.
Sure.
You
know, digital media.
Digital media is inherently flaky and fragile in a way that printed material is not.
Mm-hmm.
You've got books, you know, back in there, you know, from...
1600s.
From the 1600s. If we can keep digital data around for even another 20 years that's in existence now, that'll be a small miracle.
I agree.
I keep thinking of that last scene of Fahrenheit 451 of all the people walking around memorizing the book.
Yes.
Exactly.
This is it. This notion of kind of, at some level, perhaps in a cliched way today, sifting through an archive and kind of constantly kind of not getting exactly what you're looking for, but ending up with something that in some way relates. I've also been kind of dealing on an ongoing basis. The projects, just like with Ubu, they're constantly being rewritten on the level of code, on the level of mission statement, on a weekly basis, at least in my case. And that, again, is because of how young they are, in part. But I've been working on a number of projects in which I get automatic reminders about certain obsolete media that I'm responsible for overseeing. So given the half-life of these tapes, the system reminds me when the tape has kind of reached a certain mark relative to its original recording. So in three and a half years, I'll get an email about the fact that that mini DV tape or that DAT tape, et cetera, needs to be duped. And so I've been trying to also build in.
Why does that need to be duped in 4 years?
Because, again, this would be a difference that, for instance, I'm uncomfortable with a compression codec like MP3, even though it is, on a pragmatic level, it's perfect for distribution. I'm working on the assumption that I have right now a small repository of, 150 hours of audio. And I'm working on the assumption that every 4 or 5 years I'm going to actually re-encode it for Real Player, Windows Media, or whatever the format is. And I have to maintain that tape-based format so that I can constantly re-encode it.
You think that the MP3 format will be obsolete in 3 to 4 years?
No, but I'm more oriented towards that digital tape media.
So that's where the authenticity is.
You're
an LP collector as opposed to being a CD,
and you don't
like the abstraction.
There's more to it than that, because it's a crapshoot either way. All the storage media that we have are notoriously unreliable.
Sure.
DVDs are already starting to corrupt.
Sure. Sure.
Well, you know, when you actually submit works to the Rhizome Art Base, they ask you a question: would you be happy? Like, I have this Flash work called The Dreamlight of Letters. It's in Flash. 10 years from now, the Flash player will have been through 18 more generations or whatever. But of course, there's going to be people doing what's it called when you create the older technologies?
Emulation.
Yeah. But anyway, so they asked you, would you mind if we preserve this as a MPEG? As a QuickTime movie, or would you mind if this were recorded as video? They asked you all these questions about how you would be willing to have this archive, or do you just want it to disappear from the face of the earth if it can't be preserved in the exact?
What's so interesting about Rhizome and Mark Tribe's kind of orientation is that they also have the option that they host it or that, in fact, they do not host it. And because of that decision to not always kind of be hosting this art base that nevertheless is kind of an entry in that art base, they've been very quickly kind of overwhelmed by institutional forays into the same thing, Guggenheim and others. And so although they're part of these discussions, how do you preserve all of this fragile new media? At the same time, they have this kind of fascinatingly bizarre scenario where they have an art base which doesn't actually always have the art in it.
There's a fact that you have there, but the ceramic reproductions of all the masterpieces in Western art, making all these sort of collars and stuff.
Ceramic?
Danny Hillis and the people at MIT. The people at MIT are really into deep storage, like millennial storage. There's a book by Danny Hillis called The Clock of the Long Now. And I think so. It's the Long Now Project. And they build stuff like, metal disks with, all of the languages of the world stored on them in digital form. And they're really interested in archiving and on a scale and in a way that sort of way beyond the level that most people think about these things at. But, I did some work for the National Library of Canada. I wrote a manual for them on best practices in online publishing. And they're going nuts. Like, they don't know how to deal with this stuff at all, because they have to store the physical technology that allows you to run the media. They don't know what they're supposed to store and what they're not supposed to store, because they have a mandate to collect 2 copies of everything that is published in Canada. And the definition of publishing has changed so much that they're now trying to figure out how to make digital documents part of legal deposit. They don't have the resources. Their people don't have the training, and bureaucratic culture there is as slow as it is anywhere else. So it takes 7 or 8 years before something actually happens, and they actually have to hire somebody from outside of the government to make anything happen at all. These questions are probably going to be around for.
I agree.
I think that's one of the interesting things about archives, right? At whatever level they are, is that they're hinged, right, in temporal terms, they pivot around the center. They're hinged in two ways. On the one hand, they point backwards, right, in the conservative sense of the archive, the historical sense. At the same time, that they make this wager, right, to the future, is part of the unpredictability part. You try to imagine, you have to imagine that someone will want the information, but you don't want to imagine too closely how they'll use it. And you want some sense that it could be misused, that it could be reused. But there's also the interesting present tense part of the archive, which is you have to have a sense of what it is around you that is archivable, what it is around you that would qualify for an archive at the present in a way that makes it, in some ways, sort of ontological, in the sense that, like, if you don't come up on the Google search, that you're not quite existing, in the sense that what around us could be archived is pointing that arrow in two ways. Yeah.
I guess I'm some separate. Maybe it sounds like you're looking for some of the more obscure early works, like the Belarusian movement, for example. But in, first of all, isn't part of any sort of movement that certain texts fall away? And second, isn't also like, what do you do with some movements which, like, I mean, Spicer's sort of where you want the control distribution in a way, and you think, well, you know, let's break that open, and let that never happen again. You want to lose this sort of,
Well, I mean, I think that's certainly right at a certain level. And that, I mean, that is if you look at literary history, people do follow, look at imagism or something like that, and you know, there are lots of very important imagists who, you know, by 1915 no one had heard about. And that we don't know now, but I wouldn't want to put my project outside of history in that way too. It's also true that part of that literary history are interventions in those sorts of natural falling off, so that when Stein, you know, when Gertrude Stein's work is the unpublished materials published in the middle of the century, Stein becomes in some ways a sort of a poet of the 50s in a way that she wouldn't have. That she would like, but that she wouldn't have imagined, or that someone in the 70s does a Samizdat edition of Zhukovsky's 80 Flowers.
Like Hopkins or something, becoming a poet of the modern period.
Yeah, I mean, so in some ways it's perverse. But actually, to look at literary history, I mean, it's one of those things that happens, and I think can have important effects.
Something, I mean, Josh, there's a reductive way, which you're not saying, but there is a reductive way of applying that model of there's a kind of social Darwinian literary history, you know, when the strong survive and the weak, you know, get managed to be useful, complex, but that's all that should be.
The weaker remainder.
But actually, literary history and activity are full of temporal push pulls. I mean, even, you know, like Eliot and Hound, you know, really totally changed the 17th century, what was made. That happens a lot, right? And then there's always things. Didn't exist suddenly because of. This little story of classical in front. I'm not there, that's definitely that's what happens in time, I can't talk about that. But it doesn't happen. All sorts of things happen across that report. I think it's going to look just about like the idea that the research for the art ever cracked into any sort of like literary group and sort of recapture as it was, because that's what you kind of do that in some way. And I wonder also, like, it seems like the bad. Ends up actually having more like minor texts that are more easily available to dug up, whereas like the simpler texts, which are still available, those people went away. So kind of like an almost a minor.
Well, I want to just comment on economy. you know, obviously people hold copyrights to the major texts, and you're never going to see them on the web. So if you go to Bartleby or any of the big sites, you see lots of things that people have let copyrights expire on, and nobody wants to grab onto those. The things that are still making money are going to be held on extremely tightly, and you'll never find them. I remember once early on in the web, my father loves Gilbert and Sullivan, and I wanted to show him the wonders of the web. And so I wanted to dig up lyrics of Gilbert and Sullivan songs and say, Dad, you know, it's all here. Even the stuff that you like is on the web. And we couldn't find a fucking Gilbert and Sullivan song because they are so clamped down tight on those songs. And it was just, it was such a strange moment. But, you know,
Speaking of strange moments, can you just repeat that all? Because Aaron was changing the tape.
And oh, no, he doesn't care. We're all going to fall.
But don't worry. I'm not performing for
There's
you.
An audience here.
Well, I think it's really interesting because I think that you have to think about economies because what does, the kind of cream that does rise to the top is often based on popularity, and what does survive is the literary Darwinism, as Bob put it, is the stuff that sells really well. Now, and because it sells really well, there's thousands of copies of it, millions of copies of this stuff around the world that never disappears. It's just impossible to kill. But we invert that whole thing by putting up obscure works in PDF file, or once obscure works, and they are downloaded on /Ubu on the site that Brian curated for UbuWeb. The most popular titles on that thing, and the most popular titles is a book you've never heard of, an amazing book by Peter Manson called Adjunct and Undigest. He used to run a magazine called Object Permanence out of Glasgow. It's an amazing book. This thing, for some reason, is getting downloaded 300 to 400 times a day.
It's probably getting Googled more than any other. Because, you know, PDFs can actually be Googled now. Maybe.
It's whatever it is. And I'll, like, in some utopian way, assume that 300 to 400 copies of that book are going out and sitting on hard drives a day. And now, even if the technology, quote, gets obsolete, the kind of sheer mass of that kind of radical distribution, that is radical distribution that completely upends the equation, is going to be very, very hard to kill that book. And so, you know, we begin to subvert the entire distributive paradigm.
Well, I mean, when you're talking about paradigms of distribution and archiving, you also have to think about the technologies that actually work for searching online. Like, think about peer-to-peer and how peer-to-peer works. It's quick and it's dirty and it barely works at all. I mean, the interesting thing about peer-to-peer is it uses...
Peer-to-peer is like Kazaa and...
Napster, that kind of stuff, Nutella, and all of the clients for it, but... It uses resources that exist at the edges of networks. It does not use central databases. It uses computers that were, until very recently, considered to be not valuable parts of the internet. And the paradigm that it operates by is good enough because the files that you want might be there sometimes, but they're not always going to be there. And although you can log up, there's a website called Big Champagne. That it's the top 20 of file downloading, and you can see they have metrics for everything that's being downloaded off of all of the peer-to-peer networks, and you can see this week last real time, yeah, they have a list of real time connections and weekly updates
inevitably is Britney Spears, yeah, you know, yeah. It's so predictable and not interesting. I've never seen it, but I know what it is.
But I'm not finished because that's only part of the story. Because when I look at the arcane shit that people are pulling off of my hard drive on any given day when I'm connected to a file sharing network, you know, everything from, you know, Harry Potter books to like old R&B singles. People have all of these other interests as well as that stuff, and it's all in circulation. But it's like being in, and the way that it scales is very interesting because when you're connected to a non-centralized file sharing network, it's like being at a party where you're in a one bedroom apartment and there are 10 people in the party, and it's very easy to get to the fridge and get a beer and talk to the people that you want to talk to. But when another 40 people show up, it's harder to get to the fridge, and the people that you talk to change because the people that you were talking to are now on the other side of the room. But all of a sudden, the people that you're talking to have different things to say. So it changes over time, and that's sort of where we started with this question of, you know, unreliability as a kind of inherent quality of networks. And I think that's really interesting, you know. And the technologies that succeed online are invariably technologies that allow people to leverage the content that they're interested in and to actually exchange information. So like I just think that we'd be making more interesting art, and if people were taking these kinds of things into consideration. I mean, the interface that you're describing for slot is interesting to me on that level, but it just sort of the always already element kind of struck me, you know, when you first started to talk.
I'm interested in how we could also broach not so much just the unreliable, but this issue of kind of with Ubu. As I've kind of from a third party stance been observing it, I'm amazed at how suddenly there's this surge of kind of other curatorial practices that are being incorporated. And personally, I think that that's marked kind of like an incredible kind of renaissance of sorts for Ubu. I'm fascinated by the fact that Craig now has a project on Ubu. Brian has a project on Ubu.
We're working on one with Darren.
Bob? And I'm interested, the same thing's happening here in a live sense. There are certain exhibits, this Russian video exhibit that's curated by somebody in Moscow, and likewise live events. And we're opening up onto this, but I was wondering if you could speak about kind of why that shift, or if it's not a shift, why it's become more apparent.
That's
what we're talking about on the drive down, basically.
Yeah, I think, go ahead with that. It's interesting. I think there's a bigger issue that this is a more interesting than the personal history of Ubu, which is limited. Darren has some pretty wild ideas about aggregation and this topic, and I think maybe you should speak about that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's again, it has to do with the difference between technologies that allow you to sort of build a platform to speak from as an individual versus things that allow for a kind of collective effort. And one of the things that's happening right now as poets and everybody else discover weblogs is that everyone is going out and building their own weblog. But unless you know something about how to set up an RSS feed, unless you even know what an RSS feed is, the likelihood of connecting it to any other weblog or anybody even being able to find it are just so stratospherically small. But when you can start thinking about the possibilities of editorial collectives behind these things and starting to bring people with related interests back into smaller collectives, because that seems to be the unit that works online as a small group.
Provincial or small?
Not provincial, because I mean, even the people that the people at this table are pretty geographically scattered, and the kinds of discussions that we have and the other people that are involved in them are, you know, mostly scattered across Canada and the United States, but there are also people in Europe who are involved in the lists that we maintain and the online discussions that we have on websites and so on and so forth. But you can create these kinds of communities of interest that actually will probably do much better than weblogs by isolated individuals. And I think that process of sort of like mushrooming out into a whole series of small atomized individual sites, it's interesting, but ultimately probably not as interesting as it could be if people started looking back at smaller collective groups. Yeah, something like that. Like the weblogs that I read regularly tend to be things that are maintained by four or five people who all have very specific interests that are related somehow, but you get a much more interesting read, and the physical labor of maintaining the site drops way down. And Brian and I were talking about this, about the sheer amount of time that goes into running circulars in a given day.
Well, I think actually that the sense of the aggregate is also part of what's at the heart of the logic of the archive, actually, right, which is that archives are exclusive. Right? It's easy to see what they put in, and that's how they talk about themselves, but actually they require lots of outsides. And you know, Ubu, at a certain point, was reaching this. I mean, you may have a different reason for what happened, but you know, as I watched it, it got bigger and bigger, and the author list got longer and longer, and by creating several spheres, all with their outsides, it keeps it an archival project in some broad sense that could be very different. You'd have the same technology doing something.
But in the classic sense, each entry in that archive becomes more and more equivalent and kind of less and less singular, I would say.
Because
they each have a category that they fill, uh-huh. or a
just in like a Foucauldian monologue archive, mm-hmm. each has its place, right. and each has to be kind of put into its place and rendered equivalent to every other thing in some sense.
So that's your deeper rationale for your
It's a problematic that I can't get out of, but it's a problematic that I'm concerned and interested in dealing with. As kind of events accumulate, however I render that interface, nevertheless, they become more and more kind of one event of many, kind of less and less singular.
The last two big paragraphs, focused aggregation, small into our collectors. Very, very, very as opposed to, there may be more than, unless there are too many things, they all become flattened atoms. Radically different
situation
of what happens when there's more than one thing, a collection of things.
Well, this is my discussion. I'd be interested in what Brian has to say. When I think of the weblog, I think of noise. And I'm very much interested in this kind of textual kind of record that is returned to before distributed online. The blog is the reverse of that. It's kind of a live kind of transmission or posting of one's every thought. I mean, Ron posts enormous amounts of text on a daily basis. And my own interest is one that kind of would not be kind of posted on a daily basis, but in fact would be kind of refined before posted.
And, you know, I think that's really central. I mean, I think things are missing a lot in the discussion of the weblogs. I think the real simple fact is that it's not regularly updating people are feeding all the time. It's not like your normal everyday web page where, you might get additions to it and stuff like that. And just stuff that's there to get longer and longer. But again, maybe it's something that's happening.
I personally think that. Oh, go ahead. Sorry. I was just saying, I think the blogs are maintained by a culture of insomniacs, because I don't, and I know for a fact Ron Silliman wakes up at 6 o'clock in the morning and blogs 5 in the morning and, blogs for 2 hours, and then Nada Gordon blogs from 1:30 to 3 in the evening.
Yeah.
Yeah, my problem with
maybe you should start posting sales.
My problem with blogs it's been growing, which is that I think it plays into the kind of least attractive aspects of human literary production, which is vanity publishing, overproduction, terrible prose styles, and utter disregard for your audience. I don't. There are some people that blog nicely, but for the most part, I don't see that.
But it's instantaneous. That's the thing. It's instantaneous. It's not live. It's live. And I think that this comes back to something that's troubled me a little bit about this whole session, is that this glossed over the difference between what's live and what's instantaneous, what's accessible. And I wonder if you could just go back and talk a little bit more about the relationship between a live performance and a digital archive. Because I'm sure there are a lot of committed performers who would say that there is a lot that happens in a live performance that cannot be traced anywhere in the sort of digital recording that lay out of this room the way that we're sitting in the constitution of the all these questions. And I wonder if, either you're in conversation with performers who have some problems with these kinds of archives that they work for.
One thing I would mention is that Alvin Licht is this musician from roughly the early, he's still around, he runs Time, but he has this book called A Something Something Memoir of Martha Quinn, and he talks about how he prefers...
An emotional memoir of Martha Quinn.
Yeah, and he talks about how, when he does his recordings of his performances, he always just has a mono recording somewhere in the audience of him playing guitar. He never does digital, full-blown stereo. He actually thinks that a mono recording on audio is actually creates more opportunity for the imagination of the listener because you actually have to listen into the recording rather than having it spread out before you.
Phil Stecker's idea.
Yeah, but still, it's very lo-fi. in my sense, one thing that I think about when I think of digital decay, you know, like how this flash piece, you know, I actually converted my flash piece to QuickTime and things were missing, you know, actually some of my favorite parts were missing. And I, as opposed to like a film, you know, films, you know, when they're shown in the theater, they only actually look good for about a couple of weeks. And then anyone who's real, who's actually watching this reel being thrown through the projector, you know, you'll see the decay happening. But does this create meaning? Does this create content? I mean, Alan would probably argue, yes, I like the performance, but the mono deteriorated. Or there's a guy named Devendra Banhart who just put out his first CD, and what he did was he actually literally borrowed friends' four-track players, played his guitar, and sang into it. It sounded like garbage. It sounded like a, you know, early 20th century field recording of some folk singer. But that was information that he wanted.
Sure. But what are the relationships between those two things, the meaning the recreated digital events that space region or heard in relation to the performance, or in fact, you know, how do you archive serial performance?
How do you archive Lamont Young's Dream House? I mean, it's enough.
Well, I mean, there are people that are already engaged with this problematic and have a whole history of it. In Toronto, there's a group called Video Cabaret. It's run by Michael Hollingsworth, and it's based on a series of long plays about Canadian history, and they're, you know, something like 15, 16 different plays, and everything is videotaped, and every fourth or fifth performance is a video cabaret that's all done with monitors all over the stage instead of a live performance that includes content from previous performances, which in turn is videotaped. So you get that kind of iteration and history and, again, it's not an archive in the kind of clean traditional sense, but there is a sense of folding there that's going on where the process of documentation becomes part of the performance. And the relationship is a little more complex than a kind of straightforward, you know, event and archive of the event. The relationship that writers are starting to have to the web is similar because, you know, I'm working on a project that essentially hijacks search engines to write poems. And there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on too. You can think about number 111, you know, as a kind of slice of what Usenet looked like at a certain period in history. Because
you should tell people number 111 is.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you wrote it. You tell them what it is.
It's just a book I wrote.
It's a really thick book that takes all these. It collects every single phrase that Kenny came across over a two-year period that ended with the R or H sound. Organizes them by syllable. So the first chapter is all the one syllable ah ba ba ba. Second is, you know, retire, first responder, blah blah blah. And then of course the chapter, you know, 200 is all the 200 syllable version. So there, every chapter is basically a collection of all these phrases organized alphabetically. And the last chapter is D.H. Lawrence's The Rocking Horse Winner, which ends up with the word winner. So basically, it's an alternative archive, and as Darren's pointing out, a lot of this text was actually taken from an early version of the Internet. Well, it's the Internet, the Usenet culture, yeah.
And
the chat rooms.
And the history of the archive of Usenet is really interesting, too, because here's, you know, one of the oldest chunks of the Internet, a series of ongoing conversations that everyone on the net was having, was never archived in one place by one organization. There was a website called Deja.com, which was a search engine pointed at Usenet, and they had the biggest chunk of Usenet that anyone had.
I have a quote right here.
Oh, okay.
This is from a New York Times article in 1991, focusing on Google's acquisition of news groups from the failed information site Deja.com. In their It proposes that Google just bought Deja's Usenet archive in February with the intention of restoring the full archive and improving the message posting and searching capabilities. The company refers to its new Usenet search service available at as a quote archive of human conversation. Isn't that beautiful? That was what Google says, an archive of human conversation. Isn't that incredible? As Google Chief Executive and Co-Founder Larry Page noted, when you search Google, you're searching the equivalent of a stack of paper that's 110 miles high in half a second.
They've added to it since. Like it's gotten deeper because people have come out with tapes of older chunks of Usenet. But the problem is you can't rely on a private company to do those kinds of archival services. When Deja was going under, there was this huge discussion online about, well, what will happen to Usenet? We all wrote it. It's ours. And somebody pointed out, well, you know, no, actually, they recorded it. They own the recordings of it. They can do what they want with their database. They don't owe it to anybody, but they keep it up there as a public service. This was a concern in Canada because for a while we had these big box bookstores like Barnes & Noble, and there were two chains, one called Chapters and one called Indigo. And, I mean, everything that happens in Canada is sort of based on the idea that we should have competition, but the country's too small, so invariably these false dichotomies collapse into each other. Chapters was sort of driven by its own endless expansion to the point of bankruptcy and nearly brought the entire Canadian publishing industry down with it. It was eventually bought by its much smaller competitor, Indigo. But for a long, long time, people were saying, well, we don't need public libraries anymore because we can just go into a Chapters or Indigo and sit down and look at a book in their overstuffed armchairs and drink our Starbucks coffee and everything is fine. And the libraries at one point were actually considering selling the right to Chapters Indigo to include links to books in their card catalog into the Chapters database. So if you look for a book in the public library of, like the Metro Toronto Reference Library, and the book was out, there'd be a link at the bottom that said, buy this at Chapters Indigo. And it would splice you totally uncritically into like the mercantile system. You know? And it's incredibly creepy. And, you know, if that had gone ahead, you know, the damage could have been tremendous. And, you know, as it was, the amount of returns of damaged books that, you know, the publishing industry in Canada had to absorb nearly killed it last summer.
Yeah, but Jerry, the Barnes & Nobles are our new public libraries. And public libraries are so awful, I'm talking about in New York, and so ill-funded that kids go into the Barnes & Nobles and do all their research there. They'll spend the whole day at Barnes & Noble taking with stacks of books and coffee and lounging and living there as if it was a real public library. Public libraries
are
useless.
You could buy it for
2 weeks. Yeah, you don't have to buy anything. It's just
yeah,
it's
but
a public
what
resource.
What I'm saying is it's not a public resource.
It's better than they've got more though than what's in the public library.
Behind this discussion of Usenet, there's this kind of idea of kind of a universal archive, and there's all of these precedents from this. I'm interested in Namjoon Paik's 68 proposal to the Rockefeller Foundation to create a repository, a recording repository of all musical live musical events. So he makes this proposal and it's rejected. But the idea was that anytime there's a musical event, they send their tape in. It's kind of a naive technological model, but they send their tape in, and that gets kind of preserved. And you could have, in fact, this universal archive, maybe a Western version of that. And so, too, there's other precedents. And I'm interested in how our projects just either refuse to engage in that universalist aspiration or, in fact, at some level, comply. In terms of your question of event. I mean, all recordings are to some degree like defective recordings of the live. I think, at least personally, trying to build a framework in which you have a solipsistic notion of the event, kind of going to the recording doesn't return you to the event itself, it returns you to the recording. And so, in that practice, in that name, kind of on the web at least, there's only 2 hours out of 150 that have any video coming. The notion is, could we deny kind of that sentimental visual theme? But so I don't see them as similar. I see them as dissimilar.
Well, you said that you felt that in a while the whole event
was a meta event. It'd be nice if they could be
meta. I think that the archive is more interesting than the live event. And one of the reasons it's more interesting is just simply because of its radical distributive possibilities. Now, look, there's, you know, 10 of us in this room right now. You know, arguably, if this thing stays up and you can make it so people can find it, you know, you don't have to be here. And also, I'd rather be in my house listening to this and being here. It's more comfortable.
I think exclusivity is being undervalued here. I mean, I think there are people do like to get into groups together. They like to do things. I mean, it's just a natural thing. Like when you're in high school, you hang out with your gang. You're much cooler than everybody else. You don't make yourself
openly available to everybody as a human being. I mean, you're married, so you have a nice apartment, you go home, you want to be at home, but some people do actually like to congregate in small places.
Yes.
They want to avoid the panopticon. They don't want their, you know, and that's part of the fun, actually. You know, I mean, it's just a, you know, it's a distinctive pleasure. It's not the only pleasure, but I'm saying it's, you know, there's an argument for that. I mean, even the idea of channeling, you know, I mean, we're all talking about channeling, bringing things. I think there's this interesting notion of the sublime in terms of the aggregate, and then there's the trivial and the banal in terms of, like, the Usenet conversation. I think these giddy transformations of scale are actually what make the web so fascinating. But at the same time, the intimacy has to still be there. It is a component of that at base. The Usenet conversations did, you know, many of them were... I mean, even the Ubu list, which is our little listserv, you know, it's gotten too big. You know, if I want to toss out a joke that I think only four people are going to get, but 20 people won't, something's lost, right? I mean, but it's an entirely digital interaction.
But this notion of the universal archive, the beginning of the film archives at MoMA is this attempt to kind of build a repository of all film, and in turn, to distribute that film upon demand for almost no cost to all educators. They just have to ask them. And it failed, and so did Nam June Paik's proposal and all of these projects. And is our notion that, in fact, we're offering a radical distribution platform, which I subscribe to, that's what I'm interested in as well, is that, in fact, naive, or, in fact, is that just part of the game? We have to kind of play along with this aspiration.
What's I think the naive part is or would come from not looking at questions of granularity, like how do you mark up video for online search? I was looking at this David Shrigley cartoon this afternoon, and it was a picture of a tree, and he was making fun of fractals, and it was like a little tiny section of the tree surrounded by a circle with a little line drawn out from it that says, on closer inspection, nature is found to be really boring. You know, like, because, you know, on every level it's exactly the same, and the iterations go on forever, you know, so what? But if we had a kind of quick and dirty device like a peer-to-peer network that would allow us to grab the entire web at one search and pull out most of what we thought we wanted, the question is like what level is the granularity of that search? Where's the metadata for your, you know, hour-long each chunks of film, and how do you know what's inside it? You know, so that's an infinitely recursive problem. You know, the granularity is always receding. But that's not that far away either, because they're starting to put tags on physical objects. Like, and it's not going to be too long before every object that you buy in a supermarket has a little Bluetooth tag on it. And there's no way that all of those things are going to be erased. You're going to be walking around in the world surrounded by these clouds of data noise. And
it's beautiful.
Well, no,
you already are.
Linux. I don't think Linux is about escaping that. It's about, I mean, there are decisions on a number of levels that we need to make about the kinds of networks that we want to build and the kinds of standards that we use to connect to each other inside those networks. But then there's like a legal regulatory layer, you know, on top of the content as well. You know, like what are the standards going to be that will determine how those kinds of tags are attached to objects, when they have to be turned off, how far they can radiate, who can look at them. Like, all of those things are important questions too. And the technology, the history of technology is we have stuff for years before we know what to do with it. We had the modern typewriter for 15 years before anyone could touch type. You know, those kinds of things are, you know, first we get the technology and then we figure out what it's good for. And the problem is, you know, increasingly a political one. Like, we're sort of watching what's going on in Iraq and the kinds of things that are happening as, you know, military technology and you know, the global media market and global capital all just come banging up against each other. It all keeps getting tied up. The government was actually having to fight for bandwidth on commercial satellite networks to run their war because they didn't have enough bandwidth on the military satellite networks. So they were competing with the very networks that were reporting the war whose traffic was coming the other direction. And you get this weird moment where they have to compete in the very free market that they keep arguing for just to buy space to run their stupid war. So
the internet itself been a military technology.
Well, originally a military technology, yeah.
I mean, there's a version actually of that that goes back to your question about events, and I think that we want to differentiate between kinds of archives, that the books in here, that the archive as repository is actually a little bit different than all of our projects, which are repositories of translations, actually, right? And it might help to that. I mean, if you think of it not as failed attempts to capture something that is always going to be elegiac. You're never going to replicate something. You're never going to actually have the repository. But it's translations, and to remember that translations themselves, you know, can often be better than, think of literary translations better than the works that were originally there, and that for whatever you lose, you're also gaining things. That when you lost certain live interaction in theaters that were replaced by melodrama films, you also gained the ability to slow it down. You gained all sorts of things that we can't predict. So, as actually an economy of loss and gain that's different than the repository archive.
I'd say the whole thing with Kennedy, the Kennedy-Nixon debate, people that heard it on the radio thought that Nixon won, people that saw it on TV thought that Kennedy won, because Nixon was sweating. From what I understand, I wouldn't know.
You weren't there.
In regards to Martha Quinn, it ends up that those books belonged to her father.
Oh, really?
Really?
You know, 20 years ago, he embarked upon an attempt to kind of collect and preserve not just Shakespeareana, etc., but specifically the history of the Great Fire in London and edicts. And so I guess that's part of a larger collection.
Perfect, perfect note to end on.
I agree.
Well, RSS and RDF all come out of that, but other than that, no.
Thank you.